This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Republicans in Congress had been waiting to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act for 7 years. Then the chance came, with the GOP controlling the House, Senate, and Oval Office. But Republican leaders lost 4 votes needed to even consider the Senate bill. Then 3 senators refused to vote to repeal Obamacare now and replace it later. President Trump talks about the art of the deal, and indeed, deal-making is an art. Take the Civil Rights Act of 1964. President Lyndon Johnson shook hands and entered many a back room to get it done.
That law is the product of months of the most careful debate and discussion. It was proposed more than 1 year ago by our late and beloved president, John F. Kennedy. It received the bipartisan support of more than two-thirds of the members of both the House and the Senate. An overwhelming majority of Republicans, as well as Democrats, voted for it.
Will this Congress be able to get anything done? Or should we just get used to legislative logjams? We begin with 2 men who know about the art of the political deal. Tom Davis spent 14 years as a congressman for Virginia's 11th District, which covers most of Northern Virginia, including Fairfax. He is now the director of federal government affairs for Deloitte. Tom Davis, welcome to 1A.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also with us on the line is Mac McClarty. He was President Bill Clinton's first chief of staff and is now the chairman of McClarty Associates here in Washington. Mac, thanks for talking to us.
Joshua, good to be with you. I'm delighted to be with my good friend and colleague of No Labels Problem Solvers, Tom Davis.
Well, Tom, let me start with you. You spent 14 years in the House and decided to leave in 2008. Why did you decide to leave?
Well, a number of reasons. The place was getting a little more dysfunctional in terms of my ability to get anything done. I felt I could probably do better things with my time. But secondly, I was termed out. I'd been a committee chairman. I'd been chief author of over 100 bills that became law. And on the Republican side, you only get 3 terms as a committee chairman, and then that goes away. So my ability to move things and rotate, I think, back, you know, to more backbencher role, limited my ability to get things done. So I just felt I could do better things, in the private sector, and I think I have.
So it sounds like you kind of were seeing that Congress was getting less and less functional beyond your ability in terms of term limit rules, but just the environment in Congress
it
was.
It was. Let me say three things have occurred. One is the advent of these what we call single party districts. I was in a very swing district. I had to go out every 2 years and earn it. 80% of the House is in the districts where we know which party's going to win in November. It's kind of preordained the way the lines are drawn. Mm-hmm. So members worry about the primary elections. And primary voters are a thin ideological slice of the electoral pie. They tend to think they're right and the other side is wrong. They don't tolerate compromise. In the Senate, you have the same thing through some residential sorting patterns and the like. But you also have now, with this station being an exception, but you have media models that basically are right and left, that basically feed an audience every day what they want to hear. And so people live in contrasting universes in terms of the information they receive. And with the Internet, this is even more pronounced, what we call the crap-to-content ratio, coming over the Internet just exceptionally high. And then finally, the money in politics has moved away from the parties, which were a centering force for 200 years, out to these super PACs. So the money's moved away from the parties in the center. So basically, the center has collapsed, and the ability to compromise has collapsed. And there's good behavior gets punished, and bad behavior gets rewarded.
You know, Tom, I think you hit on 3 things that we're definitely going to talk more about in this hour. Particularly for those of you listening, we've talked about the aspect of political lines, gerrymandering, quite a bit on our program. It was one of the first topics that our listeners ever wanted to hear about. But Mac McClarty, let me come to you. This is focused on how we negotiate to get stuff done.
Yep.
And when President Clinton was elected, I wonder if you could talk about how your strategy for working with Congress worked out. Did it turn out the way you thought it would in terms of moving President Clinton's big initiatives forward?
Joshua, we were largely successful in the first year moving the president's economic deficit reduction plan forward, which was crucial because the 1992 election had been about the economy. James Carville coined that great phrase, it's the economy, stupid. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we did that on a partisan vote, which we would have certainly did not prefer to do, but we did get it passed. That was a foundational piece for the Clinton presidency. But we quickly came back with a number of bipartisan issues, including the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement and welfare to work, and a crime bill, all of which received bipartisan support. It's always, I'm a centrist Democrat, but I am a strong believer in bipartisanship. And I think despite, and Tom gave a superb Politics 101 dissertation in his 3 points, but despite individual districts and perhaps some states, the vast majority of the country, in my opinion, I think polls, Pew polls and others confirm this, want the Congress to work together, want the president to work together with both parties and get things done to make their lives better. That's always the best route. President Reagan did that. President Bush 41 did that. President Clinton did that. President Obama did it, but not nearly as much as he would like. And I think really the point that Tom made, we have moved from kind of what used to be called gridlock in Washington, which could be viewed good or bad, depending on your perspective. I think generally less than positive, but to now dysfunctionality. Mm-hmm. And the American people feel that. And Joshua, the last point I would make a little more positively is at the state level, generalization, but largely true, governors of both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are working with their legislatures, which are generally divided, in a pretty effective manner, and their approval ratings are so much better than the Congress's certainly is. So I think that's there's something to be learned from that.
We're talking about breaking through some of the log jams in Congress, what to do about it, with Mac McClarty, chairman of McClarty Associates. He's the former first chief of staff to President Bill Clinton. And Tom Davis, the director of federal government affairs for Deloitte and a former Republican congressman from Virginia's 11th district, which includes most of Northern Virginia. We welcome some of your thoughts as well and your questions about moving things forward in Congress. What's the problem? What does it take? We welcome your thoughts as well. Email us 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Marianne in St. Paul, Minnesota emailed, I'm glad this Congress is accomplishing nothing. At least that way they aren't doing additional damage. Bipartisanship requires a degree of open-mindedness that is lacking in members of our current Congress. The situation reminds me of the time when the death rate went down in California during a doctor's strike. Fewer people died because no one was performing surgery. What we need are new members of Congress who care more about country than party. Tom Davis, to Marianne's email, is the solution to this problem about the systems under which Congress operates, or is it about the people in the room? Is it possible that there are just some people for whom bipartisanship is just impossible?
Well, I think you got to look at the voters. I mean, ultimately, you have a lot of good people in Congress, accomplished people. They come there for the right reasons. But you have a political system now where bad behavior gets rewarded, and good behavior, like working compromise, taking tough votes, gets punished. I'll give you an example. My good friend Joe Wilson gets up on the in the middle of the State of the Union and yells, "You lie," in the president's speech, and raises $1 million online the next week.
You mean when President Obama was giving the State of the Union one?
Yeah. I mean, that would have been unheard of in decorum. In the old days, you take them out back, you ban them from the floor, you do something like that. Nowadays, the goofier you get, the more you get on cable news, the more money you raise with some of these groups on the right and the left, and bad behavior gets rewarded. And members who take tough votes, the super PACs are in on primaries, which is where the major race is for most of these people, punish them. And it makes it very, very difficult for people to, if you want to survive in politics, to compromise and take tough votes. Because, again, the election that counts is the primary election. The general elections in most of these states are just constitutional formalities.
Dean in North Florida writes, personally, I do hope lawmakers start working together and put party politics aside. I'm constantly bemused by the same people who supported Republican obstruction now condemning Democrats for doing what Republicans did for years. I find that hypocritical. Maybe if lawmakers did less fundraising and more socializing, what's best for Americans would become important again. Mac, I've heard from a number of lawmakers, and we heard this after the shooting at the congressional baseball team practice that wounded Steve Scalise, that lawmakers don't socialize the way they used to, and so the human connections between them fall away. They spend much more time in their districts, much less time in D.C. how much, we're low on time before we have to break, but how much do you think that's part of it, of just lawmakers looking at each other as people?
It is certainly, I think, a part of it and an important part of it. You do reach principled compromises with people that you know, that hopefully you like, and certainly you trust and respect. And without getting to know someone and having a relationship with them, you can't do that. Your email from Dean, I think Dean's got it just right. But there are a lot of factors. Tom has already really so insightfully hit the right points. But just following, you know, do no harm, that'll get you only so far, Joshua, to really move this country forward in a dramatically changing world. We've got to do some things right at the federal government level in the right way and find principled compromise to secure our people,
right,
and to lift the lives of our people. That is essential. That's what congressmen are elected to do, as well as the president.
That's Mac McClarty, chairman of McClarty Associates and former White House chief of staff for President Bill Clinton. Mac, thanks for talking to us.
Joshua, my pleasure.
And Tom Davis, director of federal government affairs for Deloitte and former Republican congressman for Virginia. Tom, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Plenty more to talk about in terms of how to break through the logjam in Congress, including Ologies, who tweeted, "What do we do when Americans' definition of work together means I want the other side to stop arguing and just do what I want?" Good question. Maybe the problem is in Congress, and maybe the problem is with us. We'll talk to some more people who know exactly what it's like to be in the room when it happens and see what maybe needs to happen a little bit differently. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing political deal-making and ways to break through the gridlock. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Lots of great and very strong comments from several of you about what's going on and what to do. John in Blacksburg, Virginia emailed, "Congress is totally dysfunctional at this point in time because in any other country, the GOP would be three different parties. This leaves the Democrats as the true majority in Congress. If you leave the majority out of the lawmaking process, nothing will ever be accomplished." Ben tweeted, "You talk about the collapse of the center and loss of compromise. Is there a fix? If not, it seems we are doomed to gridlock." Good question, Ben, and that will be our focus for the rest of this hour, what to do about it. Joining us now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Barbara Perry, the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Dr. Perry, welcome to 1A.
Good morning.
And here with us in the studio is Jonathan Rausch, Senior Fellow of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly, and the author of Political Realism: How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. Jonathan, welcome.
Great to be here, Joshua. Thank you.
Dr. Perry, let me start with you. Has it always been this crazy? Historically, does Congress just do this? Is this the way it's always been? Or does it just seem more acute because of 24-hour cable news and social media and we're looking at it all the time?
Both. and by that, I mean the founders put all of these stumbling blocks in place for a reason. The very fact that we have three distinct branches of government, that they are meant to be, there's meant to be a separation of powers, was in a way their approach to not making things go smoothly and quickly, because they feared a concentration of power. But having said that, we can go back, as we do at the Miller Center at UVA, and look at presidential history and find lots of examples, including in modern era and contemporary times, when things have gone a bit more smoothly, or at least some of the log jams have been broken through.
So I want to make sure I take part of your point. You're saying, at least in part, that the system is designed to have some viscosity. It's designed to have places where friction is built in, so deal making has to happen, although it's not supposed to kind of grind to a halt.
Indeed, and absolutely so. And I just mentioned at the federal level, the three branches of government, separation of powers, and yet we also have that throughout the cross-cutting elements of federalism. So we have three levels of government, and at each level of government, we have three separate branches and separation of powers. So between that and then things that have entered into the process, we've mentioned media and parties and other interest groups, certainly, that only gums up the works at times. And then I would add to that the fact that when we have someone like Ronald Reagan in 1981 in his inaugural address say that government isn't the solution to the problem, government is the problem, I think that leads some people to believe that the government actually shouldn't be operating because it is actually the problem.
Jonathan Rauch, you have written about some of the maybe seedy, what some people would consider maybe some of the seedier parts of government, you know, the backroom, smoke-filled room deals and political handshakes and pork barrel deals and that kind of thing. And you describe those as part of the process that may actually be beneficial, at least more beneficial than, say, the outside influence of money and messaging are on politics. Can you give us one example of that?
Well, but you mean by one example in the legislative process?
Well, yeah, in terms of the way that some of the kind of the pork barrel stuff and the backroom handshake thing that a lot of people look at and go, oh, this is what's wrong with politics.
A classic example is the one you cited in your intro, the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. Lyndon Johnson could not get that past the Southern Democrats in his own party, so he needed Republican votes. So he went to Charlie Halleck, who was the minority leader in the House, and said, what do I need to get your support? And Charlie Halleck said, you know, maybe a research grant for Purdue University in my district. And Lyndon Johnson said, consider it done. And that's how he got those votes. Now, that happened privately. It was pork barrel. It was back scratching. It was a lot of the things reformers have been trying to get rid of for the last few years. But here's the thing. That was the glue that allowed members of Congress to find ways to trade stuff so they could work together.
You know, Dr. Perry, it's interesting that Jonathan brings that up. I think I wonder how much that has been a part of the political process throughout. And of course, patronage has its own issues. Pork barrel spending has its own issues. But, you know, you look at a movie like Lincoln about, you know, abolishing slavery. There's plenty of that in that story. It wasn't just ideologues who were fighting for something they believed in. They knew how the game was played. Is that always the way the game has been played in Washington?
Oh, I think so, because it's human nature, I think, to operate in that way. And I think that something else that you touched on at the top of the hour as well with Tom Davis and Mac McClarty is the personal side of this. And so what you see in the movie Lincoln and what Jonathan's talking about with Lyndon Johnson and all of these presidents who've been successful at working with Congress, not all the time, but at least getting some major pieces of legislation through, it's because there's a personal side to this as well. And it's not just the members of Congress knowing each other, though I think that's very important. The Miller Center did the oral history of Edward Kennedy, and he and Bush 43, George W. Bush, worked really well together, smoothly together in education reform and getting No Child Left Behind passed through. And that began in part by Bush 43 recognizing he had worked across the aisle in Texas with his state legislature, so why couldn't he try that in Washington? So one of the first things he did as president was reach out to Ted Kennedy, invite him and his family to come down to the White House, sit in the White House theater and watch the movie 13 Days about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Teddy Kennedy wrote him a really lovely note after that, thanked him and said, I hope I'll be down to the White House for some bill signings in education reform and maybe health care reform as well. And at least on the first category, they got it, and a little bit of the second category as well.
We're speaking to Dr. Barbara Perry, Presidential Studies Director at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. And we're speaking to Jonathan Rauch, Senior Fellow of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Jonathan, before we go too much farther, when we talk about Congress getting stuff done, how do we measure that? How do we evaluate that? What do you think is a good yardstick to use? Is it just the number of bills that get passed or the number of deadlines that get met? Or what's our metric?
All of the above. Scholars who look at Congress, I'm not one of them, but scholars who look at it will look at the number of bills. They'll look at the volume of bills. They can also measure the significance of bills so they can tell the difference between, you know, a National Mother's Day bill and something more substantial. And they can also look at whether deadlines are met. It's been 20 years since Congress got all its appropriations bills passed on time, or even in many cases at all. And then they can look at stuff like the big crises and how often those occur. We're about to have two of them, you know, set aside health care, keeping the government open on October 1st is going to be a challenge, and passing a debt limit bill, not defaulting on the national debt, is going to be a challenge. Now, those should be routine business, but nothing's routine in Congress anymore because everything is difficult.
Yeah, to your point, Jonathan, Aaron wrote on our website, the1a.org, since 2010, Congress has been limping along, passing huge budget resolutions rather than the 13 different appropriation bills they used to pass. That means things don't work the way they did in the 60s or even the 80s. Republicans seem to have decided that they will try to pass everything through the Senate with reconciliation so that they don't even have to attempt to talk to Democrats. I remember when that was controversial. Now it's portrayed as normal. Dr. Perry, how do you view it in terms of the way we should evaluate Congress's productivity?
Oh, I think Jonathan is certainly on the right track with that, that we want to look at. And I've just noticed now that we're at the six-month mark for the Trump presidency that we've already started to see articles in the New York Times, Washington Post about how many bills has he passed and signed into law. And he will now say, Trump will say that he's passed more than any other president. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. But you can also look at these lists and you can see exactly how many have been passed and signed into law. And you can go according to Jonathan's scheme, where you say, what are the pieces of major legislation here? What are the ones that are more ceremonial?
Speaking of President Trump, let's listen to a clip of the president. He spoke yesterday as we were following the news that the Republican health bill in the Senate was not going to come to a vote in the foreseeable future. Here's part of what the president said.
So the way I look at it is, in 18, we're going to have to get some more people elected. We have to go out and we have to get more people elected that are Republican. And we have to probably pull in those people, those few people that voted against it. I don't know. They're going to have to explain to you why they did. And I'm sure they'll have very fine reasons.
That was President Trump speaking yesterday after the Senate Republican health care bill failed. It seems, Dr. Perry, that he may not have learned the lesson of this bill. I mean, it wasn't Democrats who tanked the bill. It was other Republicans who said they didn't like this bill. Are there any presidents in particular that President Trump should look to for expertise, for wisdom, for guidance, for examples of how to do this kind of intra-party leadership when it's your own party that's the problem?
Well, I think that certainly Lyndon Johnson, and we've mentioned him before, and we've given the example that he had to cross party lines. But presidents like Johnson have had to think about what am I going to do if I've got a party, my own party, that is fractured? And Lyndon Johnson's predecessor, President Kennedy, and of course Johnson mentioned him specifically in having introduced what became the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And it's always one of those intriguing parlor games: would the 64 Act have passed if Kennedy had lived? And let's face it, didn't have quite the same ability to arm twist as Lyndon Johnson did, and certainly with Congress. You know, what was it that Lyndon Johnson was able to do, or that Kennedy was able to do in the early part of his presidency when he realized he had a fractured party and he wasn't going to get a major civil rights bill passed? So sometimes presidents just have to step back and say, what is the art of the possible in politics? I would say somebody like Ronald Reagan, again, working across the aisle, had a good relationship with Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House. So it doesn't have to be that it's the president's party that's always on his side. He needs to put together a coalition of members of the willing and his own party and then reach across the aisle when that's possible.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Mike in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, wrote, gerrymandered districts creating safe seats for one party or the other mean that it's the primary election with fewer and more partisan voters that actually matters. The general election is more a coronation than a contest. Representatives are therefore always fearful of a challenge from the wings of their own party in elections, which are never more than 2 years away, and must think twice before being seen to collaborate with the enemy. Jonathan, we heard Tom Davis at the top of the program mention district lines as one of the reasons why he kind of flung up his hands and walked away. How much weight do you put on gerrymandering in terms of what's wrong with politics compared to the outside interest groups or the rhetoric on cable news? Like, where does gerrymandering rank?
Somewhere in the middle. It is a problem. It is not the problem. We know it's not the problem because the Senate is also, like the House, become more polarized and more dysfunctional. And of course, it's not gerrymandered because the lines are the lines of the states. But both Tom Davis and your correspondent are exactly right that what gerrymandering has done is meant that the primary is the real election, and the people who vote in primaries are not representative of the general electorate or even of their party. They tend to be special interests and extremists who don't like compromisers. So the people that run and then that send to Congress often are people who either don't want to compromise or feel that they can't. So that's what makes the system very sticky when you get to Washington.
Dr. Perry, what about voter participation? It occurs to me that gerrymandering works because political parties know not just the voters who live in a district, but the voters who vote in a district. And if people don't show up at the polls, they literally don't count. What do we see in terms of voter activity over time and how that affects the tone of the political rhetoric?
Well, sadly, our generally speaking, our turnout is poor. We did have some increase in turnouts for the Obama electorate and the Obama elections. In our presidential races, a little bit above 60%. But typically in primaries, if we get up to 30% of registered voters, we're doing well by U.S. standards. And so this only feeds into the point that Jonathan's making and that Tom Davis and Mac McCarty were making. And that is the people who turn out are the true believers, and those tend to be more extreme than certainly by definition the center and more extreme than the majority of Americans. And I think back to, I've quoted Ronald Reagan from his 81 inaugural address. I think back to the famous line from his acceptance speech, Barry Goldwater, in 1964, about, you know, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And I sometimes think that while he was certainly defeated soundly and roundly by Lyndon Johnson in the 64 race, to some extent, that concept has risen to the fore for many of the reasons that Jonathan's article in Atlantic, which is superb, points out.
So then I wonder, Jonathan, does that mean that it's our butts who need to get kicked and not just Congress's? I mean, we get the Congress we elected, and if we didn't elect extreme lawmakers, they wouldn't be there. Maybe it's our fault.
At some level, of course, in a democracy, it's always our fault. And if you ask people who say they don't like Congress, if they like their own member of Congress, they usually say yes. And then they usually return him to office. So you can't have it both ways. But I believe that the solution to this riddle is not trying to get turnouts boosted way up in primary elections, because the structure of primaries is such that the special interests will always be more motivated and better funded. I think that the answer is to return more power over who gets nominated to the parties and the elected officials, which is how it was done in this country until very, very recently. The idea that a few people in a few key areas would decide the nominee over the heads of the party leaders, the elected officials, the people who have to do the work, show up to govern every day, that is new and it's not working. So you need to have more input from the governors and the elected officials, the party chairman, state and local. You need to get some more sign-offs and peer review to screen out some of the bad actors.
You know, we're up against a break shortly, but Dr. Perry, I believe what Jonathan is saying would rub some people wrong, because it kind of sounds like, oh, you want to let the political class run things again. But there is some historical precedent for these decisions being made more centrally, even the idea of the Electoral College, this idea that sober-headed, thoughtful people would be choosing our chief executive.
Absolutely, because the founders feared where we are now. They feared the masses, and they feared that nothing else brings down a republic like the masses gone mad, mobocracy.
Dave emailed, people almost always behave in ways that reward them. Look to reward. In American politics, the rewards are staying in office to increase wealth and power for themselves and friends and family. To get Congress to get things done, change the reward structure. First, get obscene money out of the system. Second, impose term limits. Third, strengthen and enforce the revolving door laws. Before we hit a break, Jonathan, do you see anyone currently who you think has the power to make any of these things happen, or are these just kind of wishful thinking?
I don't think anyone has the power to make them happen, and I think they'd all make the situation worse and not better.
all of these. So getting that kind of money out of the system, like outside influence groups?
Absolutely. By going outside the system, the money is helping the outsiders overwhelm the people who are trying to govern and make the compromises.
I would like to talk more about term limits. We're up against a break, but I would like to hear from you and from Dr. Perry more about term limits in a moment, and also about other things that we could do to maybe make Congress a little more productive than it is today. Stay close. A quick mention about tomorrow's program. O.J. Simpson is about to find out if he will be let out of prison. Tomorrow, a Nevada parole board plans to hear his request for release. He's been behind bars 8 years for robbing a memorabilia dealer, not for the high-profile murder that made him a cultural flashpoint. We'd love you to share what you know about O.J., the trial, the controversies, and what it all says about America's views of race, fame, and justice. Email us 1a@wamu.org or comment on our Facebook page. As you reflect on O.J. Simpson's story, what do you think it says about race, fame, and justice in America? Comment on our Facebook page or email us 1a@wamu.org. We'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation about political gridlock and how to break it up with Professor Barbara Perry of the University of Virginia's Miller Center and Jonathan Rauch, Senior Fellow of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Let's talk about term limits. Harold in Texas asked, would term limits help Congress collaborate more effectively? Alice suggested 2 terms for representatives, 1 term for senators, and allow them to run again after a break. Maybe they'd be less concerned about re-election and more concerned about leadership while they're in office. Dr. Perry, what does history teach us, if anything, about the effectiveness of term limits on federal leaders or high-profile lawmakers?
Well, we'll start with presidents, and we know we had no term limits initially. The founders didn't see a need for that, either in Congress or for the president, and certainly not for members of the Supreme Court who served for good behavior, which means life. And in the case of the last president who didn't have a term limit, Franklin Roosevelt, who was elected 4 times, is considered among the greatest presidents ever to serve. So I'm not sure that term limits equal great leaders. I'm a little skeptical of them myself, and I think that we have term limits. Term limits are elections. And states, by the way, some states tried to implement term limits for members of Congress from their states back in the late 80s and 90s, and some passed laws to that effect, and the Supreme Court struck those laws down.
Why did the Supreme Court strike them down?
Indicating that that would be a lack of uniformity if some states had term limits and some states did not.
Jonathan Rauch, what do you think about the idea of congressional term limits?
It's beside the point. It probably makes things worse. Look, Joshua, where did these problems come from? One of the things that needs more attention is that the 2 big things happened in the last 40 or 50 years. The public decided they wanted to get the professionals out of politics, and reformers decided they wanted to get the politics out of politics, meaning, you know, the big money and the lobbying. Well, the problem is it's the professionals and the politics that make the system go. So when you get rid of the pork barrel spending in the Appropriations Committee, or you try to push the money outside the system, you take away from politicians the tools that they need. And politics is really, really hard. So you need people who know what they're doing, who are experienced professionals at the arts of compromise, and who will be there long enough so they have to live with the consequences of the decisions they make. And term limits work against all of those things. That's the kind of reform that got us into this mess.
It's so interesting to hear you say that it sounds like you're saying that we need more of what people would consider politics as usual.
Correct.
People who come to Washington, stay in Washington and say, I'm coming to play the game and I'm not leaving till they drag me off the field. That we're better off with that?
Yes, we're better off with that. You need hacks, you need political machines, you need all the favors and the back scratching. The Constitution provides no way to hold politicians accountable. If you're elected and I'm elected, I can't make you do anything, even if I'm President Trump. So we have to incentivize each other. So I need to, if you help me, I'm going to drop some money on your district, or I'm going to help you with that airport runway, or, you know, maybe I'm going to say, you know, you help me this time, I'll help you next time.
I want to be clear about what you're saying. When you say hold lawmakers accountable, you talk about, I think you mean in terms of their campaign promises or their platform, like if they go off and become a maverick in the party, not if they break a law. That's right. What you mean, right?
Right.
Okay,
that's,
just wanted this
exactly
to be clear.
Right. That's exactly right. You don't want an entire Congress made up of 535 individual entrepreneurs who won't work together because they're all too worried about what's happening in the district back home. So you need to give them ways to have influence over each other. And you do that with hacks and machines and favors and backroom deals and all of the kinds of things that we've been busy reforming out of existence now for 40 or 50 years.
Ken in Friendship, Tennessee asks, what happened to statesmen? Is there anyone in Congress we could call a statesman today? Jonathan?
Well, there's some people in Congress that I like and respect. And I think we all have our choices. I'm a huge admirer of John McCain, though I disagree with him on some policy things. But he's a particular hero of mine, and I'm praying every day that he's going to be all right. I'm sure many of your listeners are. But I would say that to me, the problem is not the individuals. The problem is, we talked about this earlier, the problem is the system and a set of incentives that reward people for behaving badly and not compromising. And that's where we really need to focus, fixing those rules.
A number of you have said to us that you don't think it's necessarily the whole system, but certainly one party over another. Ron commented on our Facebook page, bipartisanship means giving the Democrats what they want. Fergus tweeted, put Democrats in charge. They always cross the aisle too often, whereas current Republican politicians are pure partisan hacks. Enhanced Vibes wrote on our website, the1a.org, it's too difficult for some Republicans to admit they were wrong about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and should work with Democrats to make it better. You know, like the way Congress used to work. Pride and party over policy. I mean, there's a reason they haven't worked on it at all in the past 7 years. They never thought they'd have a chance to repeal it. It's all been lip service for their constituents. Dr. Perry, how much do you think this is really the problem of the GOP? And not necessarily of Congress in general. A lot of Democrats would say, we would love to work with them, but this is how they prefer to play the game. Are they right?
No, I agree with Jonathan on this, that so much of this is systemic and that it's having an impact, perhaps a little bit more for the reasons that he spells out in his article on the Republican Party, but that the Democratic Party is just as open to these systemic changes. So I think it tends to be, some of these comments tend to just be partisan in themselves to say, oh, this is all one party's problem and not the other. Again, because I think these systemic changes have had impacts on both parties, as we saw in 2016 with the rise of Donald Trump and the candidacy of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party.
Well, but I don't think there's anyone analogous to, for example, the Roger Stones of the world in Democratic politics. Like, there are certain kinds of politicking that I think for a lot of Democrats, they just don't see an analog in their own party. Jonathan, what do you think?
The parties are different right now. There's no question about it. There's a bunch of political science that has come out on this. The Republicans are behaving more out of ideology. The Democrats are still more back in the world of being a coalition of different groups that want different things. Republicans are further to the right by most objective measures than Democrats are to the left, though they're both becoming increasingly polarized. I've been on record as saying that both parties have a problem, but whereas the Democrats' problem is chronic, the Republicans' party is acute, and the number one piece of evidence for that is that the president of the United States, elected as a Republican, is not in any meaningful sense a Republican.
You know what? Explain that a little bit further, Jonathan, and then Dr. Perry, I'd like you to talk more about kind of these ideas of what we think of when we think about what the parties stand for. But Jonathan, for you, what is maybe the one biggest area in which you don't see President Trump as a true Republican?
Well, apart from the fact that, for example, he registered once as a Democrat, twice as an independent, and twice as a Republican over his career, that he, even as president, speaks of Republicans as them, not us, that he campaigned against his own party as an outsider, that he smashed to ribbons most of what the party thought it believed in, and that he has no roots in the party. Now, the payback for that, unfortunately, is then he gets to be president. And he's got support in the grassroots, but he doesn't have support in the party leadership. He hasn't done favors for anyone. And it turns out they're not that scared of him, so he can't get stuff done in the party. That's That's the problem when the party loses control over who its own nominee is going to be.
Dr. Perry, what about that? I mean, we have political parties in this country that didn't exist when we were early as a nation. We have political parties that did exist and don't exist anymore. You know, the Whigs aren't around anymore. The Federalists are long gone. Is the whole political party thing just kind of the way it goes when people say, for better or worse, we need to flood the Republicans, flood the Democrats, and change it from the inside? What does history teach us in terms of the way that works out?
Well, I would say, as I sit here in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the home of Thomas Jefferson and the university that he founded, that the modern Democratic Party traces its roots to Jeffersonian party, the Democratic Republicans, as they were called. But the history teaches us that we have a two-party system because we don't have a parliamentary system. We don't have proportional representation. So we have two parties, and we've had the same two parties since just before the Civil War, and they have tended to be these big tents in that they would take in many, many different people and factions from across the country as it expanded, and they would therefore move to the center so that they could take in as many people as possible and not put any groups off. And that's what we have lost. We've also tended to see changes in the parties when we've had crises such as leading up to the Civil War. We hope we won't have something that severe. But I would point to someone in contrast to a Donald Trump figure, as Jonathan quite correctly described him, and that would be Dwight Eisenhower. And that is the statesman that some of your listeners have been looking for, who was not perhaps a natural Democrat or Republican in the sense that he was a military leader and he was nonpartisan. And both parties courted Ike to run at the top of their ticket in 1952. But he chose and felt most comfortable with the Republican Party. That's the kind of person that I think people are searching for these days.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's get to a few more of your comments, including this voicemail that we got in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Marie, and I'm a mental health nurse. I believe that the Affordable Care Act was the last thing Congress did that really made a big difference. I watch my patients knowing that they have coverage, knowing that they can get the medications that they need and can keep themselves safe and therefore our community safe. I think that's made the most significant difference for my patients and the people that I see on a daily basis.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling in with that. Jonathan, I recall President Obama went in basically his signing speech saying, this bill is not perfect, we'll have to improve it over time, but this is a good start. How much of the current fight over the Affordable Care Act do you think is just the Republicans hating it, as opposed to perhaps, and I'm just floating this, maybe not enough being done to set up a bipartisan future for it, to make sure everyone felt included, everyone started working on reforms right away? Like, was there any way to prevent the current legislative fight we're seeing now?
It would have been hard. President Obama and the Democrats very much wanted a bipartisan bill. The Republicans decided to rerun the playbook they ran in 1993 against Hillary Clinton's health bill and just not participate. The result of that was the Democrats went with a Democratic bill, and it's just a standard fact in political science that when you're talking about a huge, massive reform, it's very difficult without buy-in from both parties, because when you've got half the country against you, it's hard to make it stick politically and it's hard to make it work procedurally. So we got started on a road that was very difficult, and then it only got more so.
Carolyn in Cincinnati writes, this show assumes that the failure to pass a horrible bill is problematic. I think the Senate did its job in that the health care bill was bravely blocked by a few senators who listened to their constituents and their concerns raised against very bad legislation rather than succumb to party pressure. Polls show the majority of Americans were opposed to the health care legislation. And Joel writes, I guess compromise sounds like a good word, but I don't buy that the best answer to our issues always lies in the middle between the two parties. Dr. Perry, what do you think of that? This idea that maybe stonewalling is exactly what's best for the country at that moment, and we look back on it as the right thing to do.
Well, I think Carolyn and Joel raise good points, and that I don't think what we're saying or concluding is that we must always have action. Obviously, we want good action, and people are going to disagree over what the word good means in that context. But I think what the country is longing for is constructive action, and constructive action that is addressing the many problems that our country faces at home and abroad.
Quick question from Fanny for you, Dr. Perry. Fanny asks, is there a historical precedent for a U.S. president saying they hope a law that has been passed by Congress fails, referring to President Trump saying that he hopes Obamacare fails?
That one doesn't come to mind immediately, but I think that that's where we are, is what we've been describing today. And I think the point that we've made about Trump and that I make often is that by and large, on just about every point that we can think of, he is unprecedented. So he's unprecedented by the fact that he had had no government or military experience coming into the presidency. And he's unprecedented in his larger-than-life personality. but I'm sure, of course, that there have been laws that have been passed and signed into law that occasionally presidents think back and maybe think at the time that it's not something that they would have wanted for themselves.
Before we are low on time, Jonathan, a number of people have been asking about how a third party might affect politics. Paul tweets, is it time for more than a two-party system? What do you think?
Well, in one sense, it's always been time for more than two-party system, but it never will be because the way our Constitution and system is structured, as Dr. Perry said earlier, we don't have proportional representation, so you're pretty much throwing your vote away if you vote for a third party. And as long as that's the case, what we need to do is think about fixing the two parties that we've got right now.
Dr. Perry, what do you think?
Oh, I think Jonathan's absolutely right. The system is such that it's not going to support a third party, at least for long. Again, under our historical precedents for parties and our two-party system, when a third party developed, it either became one of the two major parties, rarely, but that's how the Republican Party developed before the Civil War, or, and more likely the case, the third party would be taken in by one of the two big tent parties of the major two-party system.
And Jonathan, very briefly before we run out of time, what do you think is the next available opportunity? If Congress wanted to get its act together, say today, what do you think is the next big opportunity for some collaboration and some progress to be made?
It's going to have to be the smaller things initially. It can't be health care right now, but it's got to be some of the things like the appropriations bills. Some of the routine business needs to become routine again. And that's not colorful stuff. That's like dealing with the farmers and it's, you know, dealing with the veterans and so on. But that's the level where you can start to rebuild trust and collaboration.
That's Jonathan Rauch, Senior Fellow of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, contributing editor at the Atlantic Monthly, and the author of Political Realism: How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. Jonathan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Barbara Perry, the Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Dr. Perry, thank you.
Oh, Joshua, it's my pleasure to be with you.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.